Ooh.
Hey.
Hey. So, welcome to the podcast for Empathy and Imagination. This is our first go at this. My name is Aubrey. With me is Drew.
Say hi there. Hello. Hi.
And Inferno is here too, which is a quadruped canine. It's Drew's dog. Mm-hmm. Inferno, say hi.
Okay. He's pretty shy. Yeah. That's fine.
He doesn't speak English either.
So, topics.
Topics.
Today's date. That's a topic. What's today's date?
What is today's date? Today's October 20th. It's a Tuesday. It's about 6:30 p.m. We are located in Richmond, California.
Yeah, we're at my home in Richmond. Lovely afternoon, patio, garden. It's nice.
Yeah, it is nice. It beats working.
Yeah, we were talking about that. Beats working.
So we both work at Cafe Gratitude in Berkeley. It's one of our jobs.
Mm-hmm. What's your role there at Cafe Gratitude?
Well, I work 2 days on the line as a line cook and 2 days behind the bar.
What's it like to be a line cook? What's that like?
You know, I enjoy it. I have to say I enjoy it more when I'm working alone. I think it's like a control thing. But in general, it's a good job. It's steady. Pays the bill.
What do you like about being a bartender?
Bartending, I like probably the interaction with customers. You don't get as dirty as you do on the line. A little more variety, I suppose. Variety is important.
A little more variety than the line, because the line is just repeating, you say.
Yeah.
There's a dish.
And you can't really interact with people on the line, customers.
Yeah. It's actually frowned upon when they come up to the counter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I frown upon it. So, yeah, we were talking earlier. Got some weird kind of energy going on today. Mm. I had a bicycling accident
last night.
Where I swerved to avoid a reckless driver.
Mm.
Jackknifed front wheel. Got a big old Charlie horse on my thigh. Mm. And
how fast were you going?
I was probably going like 15.
Oh, so you're cruising.
I was cruising. That night, it was dark.
How'd you land?
Well, jackknifed, and then I kind of listed, fell to the left.
Hmm.
And scraped up my hand. And so, yeah, that was yesterday night.
Did you interact with the reckless driver afterwards?
No, they were not aware enough to be interacted with.
As in they left.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It like made me kind of bummed out or something today.
Hmm.
Or just felt kind of stressed about it.
Hmm.
Or like worried about something.
Hmm. Do you think you might feel worried about your body being injured?
Yeah. And, you know, no matter how safe you are, you can't account for reckless drivers. So, I mean, I'm okay, so that's good, right?
You're here.
Yeah.
You made it.
But yeah, just, you know, getting hurt. It's like if you get beat up or something.
You know,
you kind of feel like shit the next day.
It's like, for all of you that are learning just now, Aubrey and I ride our bikes in a really fun and serious, regular way. We have a title. We are the Bike Order Warriors. And what we do is we pack camping gear onto our bicycles and ride up mountains and camp semi-legally in campgrounds all around the Bay Area. It's super amazingly fun. And we have this whole safety thing that Aubrey invented. I really like. It's a really cool way to think about riding a bike. Would you tell us about that, Aubrey?
Well, I wanted to come up with a mnemonic device to remember how to be safe before getting on your bike. So kind of like a pre-flight checklist or pre-cycle checklist. And so I came up with the mnemonic habits. H-A-B-I-T-S.
Habits.
Because you want to be in a habit of safety. So habits stands for helmet, air, brakes, illumination, tidiness, and seat height. And kind of an order of importance. First three are probably the most important. Helmet, air, and brakes. So you got a helmet on your head, you got air in your tires, and your brakes are functioning properly.
Yeah, before you even start moving.
Yeah. So habits. So when you think you got to get into the habit of habits before you get on your bike.
Yeah. Love that, man. Yeah, that's so cool.
You had an injury experience too, didn't you?
I did.
Was that today?
That was last night. Okay. Yeah. So here, it's an interesting story. Here in my home, we have an Airbnb room that we have up. And currently we have our second guests ever staying in the room, and they brought a dog. A big, beautiful, curly brown, I forget the breed, but it's a purebred curly brown dog. It's about 100 pounds. Looks somewhere between a Rottweiler and a chocolate lab with curly hair.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a person who is under the impression that I'm getting pretty good at being able to communicate with dogs that other people deem training. What I like to do is think about communicating with dogs and having their needs met as well as our needs met, as far as how they can live with us more peacefully instead of trying to make certain training methods wrong and other ones right. I'd rather just discover what actually works for them.
Hmm.
So anyway, their dog has some real issues with, like, violence and anxiety. And this is a big dog with big dog teeth.
How big of a dog is it?
He's about 100 pounds.
So he weighs about twice what I weigh.
Yeah, just about. Aubrey has no legs. He actually rides a bike with a machine. It's really just his hip.
A hip and a head. That's it. But I do wear my helmet. So.
So this dog's here, and the guy we were talking about, we were really having a really good conversation. It was a really lovely chat we were having with these guys and their dog and stuff, and they were really open to listening, and I was feeling really open to them being not interested, and it was really good. It was really communicated that that they were in the impression that I could help them, and so I was like, I can show you. And they're like, yeah, we were just about to pay somebody a bunch of money, and I'm like, it's just simpler than that. It's all about energy.
Yeah, it's paying you a bunch of money.
No. Yeah, just paying me a bunch of money. It's simpler than that. It has to do with your energy and your emotions when dealing with the dog. If you're afraid of the dog knows. If you feel calm, confident, in charge, the dog knows that too. And they need our leadership to get along in our super complicated world.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think I give myself the experience that dogs are really good at showing us certain things about life and about training us and about keeping us happy. And they really could use our help with this complicated as hell world, because, I mean, they're not able to put it together like us with the frontal lobe, prefrontal cortex. So it's like, it's different, you know? Anyway,
yeah.
This dog bit me. So I was doing this move on the dog. I had the dog. I got in his space. I moved him. I didn't, like, even really touch him. I just maybe leaned against him and got him to scoot back. Just used standing up using my legs.
Mm-hmm.
And I had him sit, and he sat, and his tongue was out. He was relaxed. I praised him. I was like, good boy. Where's the treats?
What's the dog's name?
Dog name is Blue.
Blue.
Blue. I was like, good boy, Blue. And I was petting his head, and I was petting his back. And I was like, where's the treats? Let's get the treats for this guy. Hell fucking yeah, he did it. And I came back to praise him more, and he snapped and bit me right there in the middle of being praised. I didn't see any signs. Like, usually the dog will warn you before it does something like that. Usually they're like,
growling.
Like, give me some space, dude, I need some space.
Yeah.
And I do, you always do that, give them their space.
Sure.
Unless there's a threatening situation where you need to help, it's different. Anyway,
So, do you think he was trying to, like, give you a kiss, or was it...
He snarled and struck. He attacked my face, basically.
Huh.
It wasn't a kiss. It, like, totally, totally startled me. But I knew it was a possibility.
Yeah.
I knew that if I'm going to be fucking with a 100-pound dog that has serious emotional problems, that I am dancing with danger, and that it's part of it. So I have this big cut in my lip right now.
Mm.
And it might actually make me sound a little different in future podcasts because my lip is swollen. And it kind of looks cool, though. I'm going to really admit that, like, where it is on my lip. What do you think?
Looks cool.
It looks kind of cool.
You just have to say that you don't have herpes.
Yeah, I have to say I don't have herpes, though. And then right under my right jaw.
I mean, you don't have to say that. You don't have to do anything.
Right under here, my right jaw hurts, too. Because the dog connected this hole with this jaw, with my chin.
Kind of bit your... One fang in your mouth and one fang in your... Under your chin.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I got scared.
Yeah.
And it was all right, though, because after I cleaned the wound and got it, like, washed and held pressure on it, stopped bleeding, and it was fine. It was a gape about a quarter inch. It was like a hole, like a circle about a quarter inch around.
Some blood?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some blood. Hmm. And I calmly go talk to the guys afterwards, and I'm like, hey, guys, like, this is... It's you guys said yourselves that you have a fear that he's going to do this to people in public.
Mm-hmm.
If your goal is to have more direction ability for his behavior in public, if that's what you want, then it's going to take energy changes. You're going to have to show leadership in an energetic way that he can trust and relax. And then he really listens to me. We went on a walk, right? I did not touch that dog again that night.
Mm-hmm.
I was like,
Was this yesterday?
This is last night.
Last night. Okay, so we both had some injuries occur last night.
Interesting. By quarter
wound. By accident, too.
But yeah. Surprise. Real surprise.
Hmm.
So we went on a walk, and I had them do exactly, like, I said, stand here, go here, tug here, stop there, say this. And he very much, did everything I requested very gracefully, very happily. The owner of the dog. Because he could see that it was needed and helping.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was cool. So we're going the walk, and he has this breakthrough. So we're going down these stairs. Because we're on a hill here in Richmond. In between the two freeways, there's this big-ass hill. And we're just on the good side of where the train tracks aren't. So that's cool. You can hear the train. Yeah, hear it?
Oh, yeah. I don't think our listeners can hear it.
Maybe. If you can't,
our mics aren't that good.
On this episode.
Yet. Yet.
So he finally has a breakthrough where Blue does this thing where he looks at him, he says. Blue gives him this eye, and he won't move. Blue just sits down and won't tug. No matter how much the owner pulls, he just gives up and eventually has to go where Blue wants to go. And that's how he's lived his life. And I showed him, I was like, we're going down the stairs. And I said, have him sit, and then you walk down the stairs. Have him stay. And he said, sit. And Colin walked down the stairs, but then Blue immediately followed. He's like, I said, no, bring him back up there. And he was trying to pull him up, and Blue gave him a look and sat down. He's like, I'm not going back up there. I'm not doing that.
Okay.
And this is where the breakthrough happened, where I was like, okay, Colin, this is the energy we were talking about. You got to take that and turn it up. Like this dial in your chest. Like reach in and turn up the energy of what you know is needed here. And he did. He fucking did it. He jumped. He like got in the dog's space. And with loving patience, the dog got out of it. He snapped out of his state and moved back up the stairs.
Hmm.
And sat down.
And stayed.
And sat and stayed. And he came down the stairs and stayed. He got it. They got it. And he was like, I mean, he was so sparkly-eyed. The young guy. It was really cool.
Hmm.
Yeah.
There's Inferno.
There's Inferno. Yeah.
Takes him a while to say hi, but there we go.
He's a little shy, and he expresses his shyness through
angry
fear.
And shy, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
They were really overjoyed by the walk. He said that he felt that there's this transition, and it was like amazing. And so I think the message has begun with that whole experience. This is after the bite.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, So that's what happened.
Hmm. How old is the dog?
Dog's, I think, like 2.
Hmm. So it's pretty young. Did you communicate non-violently with the guest? This is Airbnb guest, right?
Yes, this Airbnb guest. They were so apologetic about him biting my face and the blood coming out. They were really like, oh, I'm so sorry. And I really expressed, I heard they're sorry. I was like, yeah, I really hear you. I hear that you feel sorry. I totally accept your apology. It's totally fine. And I told them, like, I figured this was a possibility. I even talked about it with my partner the night before. I was like, it's possible this dog's going to hurt me.
Yeah.
I knew. I said it. I was like, I kind of feel a little bit psychic about that. Because the night before I mentioned it was possible because we were talking about me helping Blue. And he was like, oh, he's bitten my mom. I'm afraid of him biting. I was like, it's possible. And then it happened.
Mm.
So.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they can, you know, I think dogs can pick up on that energy, definitely. I don't know what the mechanism is for that. If it's smelling certain secretions or something, or just sixth sense.
I think it's a little mix of both.
Mm.
I think dogs are, everything is, I think, a little bit psychic in some way I don't fully understand.
Mm.
But, yeah, dogs smell, can smell like the chemicals in our brain.
Hmm.
So I've been told.
So Blue is in the room right now, right?
Blue's in the room right
Locked
now.
Locked in the room?
Yeah, he's in the room. The guys are out. One's at work, other one's job hunting.
Hmm.
And Blue's in the room. I've interacted with him a few more times since the incident, and he's not shown any sign of aggression, but has still been pretty, not too jazzed about verbal requests.
Yeah, he seems kind of willful.
Yes, yeah, I'm pretty willful. Which is cool. I mean, like, I do want Inferno and Blue to totally have willful experiences of joy, just, like, play in any direction and feeling free and have that. I think it's really important, even on walks, for that to occur. But it seems as if that there's a way to communicate our needs as well in a consensual way.
Hmm.
So it's interesting, man. We both had these weird injury accidents last night.
Yeah.
And then here we are for our first podcast. I wonder if there's some, like, I don't know, lesson or something.
Hmm. Give us something to talk about.
Hmm. That's what I'm thinking.
Not that we have challenges with that, but trying to get myself all jazzed up, and felt kind of just dead or something. Apathetic.
Apathetic.
Apathetic. Mm.
What is that? What does that energy do?
Just makes me tired and makes me not look forward to anything and kind of have a bleak outlook where, like, anything I have to do is just...
like, burdensome?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I make up that it's burdensome, mm-hmm. You know. Actually doing it, it's fine. I mean, this is great. It's fun.
Yeah.
I was expecting to have a little more pep. But that's all right. That's life. Here we are. And this is good.
I'm taking some of my medication.
Mm. Mm,
I have a doctor's prescription for something called cannabis. And I'm taking some of my medicine right now.
Okay. What do you see for the future of medical cannabis use?
That's an awesome conversation point.
I mean, it's easy to see it being legal everywhere.
Yeah, I think for the future medical use is well, there was some story about a recent bill either trying to do that or doing that the federal medical ban would be lifted, so states could choose medically, but still recreational is total boner jam, which means they have to move it off of a Schedule 1 status.
So it would be state regulated
for medical, but not federal. Still illegal federally that Colorado has a humane policy for people with a different lifestyle than those in Washington. So that's cool. I think the future will be really cool when it goes fully legal, when we can really study all the different cannabinoids, when we can really explore CBD's total potential, where lots of people can cross-check and verify and use the scientific method to explore all the different chemicals in this plant. How to crossbreed, how to cultivate, how to concentrate.
Crossbreeding.
Crossbreeding.
Because that's essentially genetic engineering, right?
It is genetic. But that's what all crossbreeding has been. Right. For all the wheat we've all eaten.
Selective breeding, right? Yeah. Dogs, too.
Same thing. This guy. Yeah. Inferno. Boxer, Rhodesian Ridgeback, Shar-Pei.
Shar-Pei, really?
Yeah. Huh. Everyone who sees him, the first type they say is Shar-Pei. Like, is Shar-Pei in him? And I'm like, well, I think so. Yeah, he's got to.
He just doesn't have those, like, folds and folds of skin on his face.
No. Yeah, so I think that when we're able to really discover all the stuff, all the CBD and THC and all the other cannabinoids, and we can explore their specific medical uses, I really think we're going to replace a lot of prescription drug companies with weed. I think there's a lot of medications that do certain types of things really, really poorly with a lot of harmful side effects.
Yeah.
That cannabis will replace. We'll use the fucking stems to make cool shirts and rope and stuff. It's like, we used to have the hemp. Everyone knows the government forced you to grow hemp.
Right.
Used to be Mando because it's so badass. The Declaration of Independence is on hemp, I think? I don't know.
Huh.
Something like that. All the old school dudes, they definitely talked about hitting the sweet pipe.
Yeah. So the cannabinoids.
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 Trying to trick me.
Those are,
there's like more
those are like the active.
Those are the measurable chemicals.
Okay.
Yeah.
THC is one of those.
Mm-hmm. Tetrahydrocannabinol, something like that. So that'll be really interesting. I think it'll end up helping a lot of people, and I think it's also super entertaining. I very much believe in its medical and recreational value. There's this great documentary that I really have. I got the most excited about this documentary over any other documentary that I've seen since Zeitgeist Moving Forward. And that is Culture High. It's on Netflix, probably other places too.
Okay.
It's called Culture High, and it's really about why marijuana is still legal. I think it paints a really cool picture.
Why it's still illegal?
Why it's still illegal.
Right, okay.
Maybe we'll like put a link in the notes or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It talks about in the ways that the police force towards minimalist users and how that goes in their record books as an arrest. And that counts just as well as catching a drug cartel who's killed 18 people and makes millions per year. That's like the same dollar count in the cop logbook. So it's easy, it's cheap to get paid. There's some evidence for that. And the fact that these drug enforcement agencies collect seized money in 80-20 split with the feds.
Feds get 20?
I think so. Yeah. I think so. And they get to keep the money. And so what they're doing is they're buying military-style policing equipment.
Right.
To do more of that.
It's like LAPD.
Yeah.
They have like a full... It's like an army. It's like a small army.
Yeah. So like the Oakland PD has the capacity to like roll the fuck out super hardcore. But it's like none of the people... Like, what would we even do? How would that even necessitate that? Like, what could we, like, Occupy didn't necessitate that.
Yeah.
In my view. Did you participate with Occupy, Aubrey?
I did not. It didn't seem to be doing much.
Yeah.
It's more like just, it's kind of slacktivist, right? It's kind of like you're buying into the narrative that you're changing something, but, I mean, I think... the best of intentions were there, but it just seemed like a reason to camp out and like have a mini Burning Man type experience under the auspices of, you know, ostensibly saying, oh, we're doing this for a cause, but it didn't seem to really amount to much.
Yeah, the thing about it, I did participate with some Occupy things, but they didn't have a direction.
Yeah.
All they had was the anti. And when they tried to organize, it was like a disaster. I remember being at the Oakland downtown, and they're like, the shout repeating was a really popular method to disseminate information from certain leaders to other groups, where people would just shout, repeat what they heard.
Mm-hmm.
So other people could hear it. And that was an interesting method that was kind of cool, but I went to some other places in San Francisco where they were trying to have, like, democratic meetings with... It was so crazy that they were... seemed to be so protesting this super crazy bureaucracy, while what their answer was to bureaucratically go as hard as possible to try to solve the problem of who's supposed to lead the revolt.
Mm.
And I became disinterested, because I have the belief that bureaucracy is on a scale at one end, and the other end is trust. And that,
right,
like a gradient, like my interactions maybe are a gradient between trust and bureaucracy. I understand that if you very much trust people, like if you have a solemn family that you trust, you still might have notes about what you do together. You still write things down about things you did.
Yeah.
And that's like a very, very, very faint form of bureaucracy, right?
Right.
Because you're keeping track, it's notation. So on the other end, if you are experiencing tons of bureaucracy, you're like buying a house,
mm-hmm,
or getting some kind of loan, or trying to start a business, or change a law in a city. Like you're dealing with a mountainous, multi-month wave of bureaucracy hurdle, which I feel is only there to replace what was lost when trust was lost.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, they say that contracts exist because people don't trust one another, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we all trusted one another, we wouldn't have to write it down. It would all be kind of gentlemen's agreements, right?
Mm-hmm.
Handshakes.
Mm-hmm.
Handshakes and, yeah, mutual understanding. Maybe that'll happen one day. A trust-based, resource-based economy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Trust and resource-based economy.
Man, that's something awesome. Would you be interested in taking a short break?
Sure.
All right, well, so we're going to take a short break.
Podcast for Empathy and Imagination, episode 1.
Topics.
The idea is we're both fans of Empathy and Imagination, and so we're going to bring our interest and our curiosity about those two concepts to other topics that we discuss. And eventually we'll have guests.
Yes.
Every now and again. That's the idea, really.
Yeah.
Conversations. Convos.
Mm-hmm. again, topics.
Topics, yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking convos as a potential title.
And you know, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, you know, I think I might have a topic.
Yeah.
You know, you could send us a little note on the interwebs.
That's right.
Podcast for empathy and imagination.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Because, you know, we have no ideas of our own, so.
Right. Soon it'll just be a reality TV show that's scripted.
Right. God, what a horrible thought. Friendship, the reality TV show.
Something interesting to note. So something I feel like I've learned is that when you're hanging out with a friend, and sometimes it gets quiet, learning that that's actually fine, and that silence is fine, and that you can just be silent with your friend. Some time can pass. If something arises, something will. But the need to fill it, I sort of let go. I thought it was pretty cool.
The need to fill silent spaces?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So now if I'm with a friend, like now, and it goes silent, I don't feel worried about what's going to happen. I just relax into what happens.
Hmm. That's probably why you're a good conversationalist, a good listener.
Hmm.
And a good conversationalist.
Well, thank you.
Was that a recent realization? Or
I'd say a couple years ago.
Yeah.
A couple years ago.
I feel like I've been a shy guy my whole life. Got over a lot of that. Worked on that a lot.
Hmm.
So I can definitely get on board with that, because I never felt the need to fill the silences.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah, I definitely did when I was a kid.
Yeah. Or maybe I was making up my own story of it being awkward. Like I felt the need maybe to fill the silence, but didn't. Because I was too shy or something.
Hmm.
But yeah, that's a good realization. I think that makes people better listeners, for sure.
So, Aubrey, where are you from?
I'm from Earth. I was born in Plymouth, Massachusetts. And then I lived in Colorado. And then back in Massachusetts. And then in New York State for college. Then back to Massachusetts, and now here in California.
What did you study in college?
I studied computer science.
How long were you there?
I was there 4 years.
Hmm. Did you get a piece of paper at the end?
I did.
What's it say?
It was not made on hemp like the Declaration of Independence.
Hmm. What was it made on?
No, it's made on, I don't know, you know, just paper. Parchment paper.
Parchment paper. Probably thick. What did it say?
Semi-thick, yeah. It said, blah, 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 Bachelor of Arts in Computer Science.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool.
Big deal, right?
Right, big deal.
Got a piece of paper after 4 years. And I've said this before in my life, but all the things I learned in college were, so few of them were academic things.
Hmm.
Hmm. I don't think college is for everybody. I definitely had a great time there. Met some great people and great friends.
You're still in touch with those people from college?
Yeah, not all of them, but most of them.
That's cool. So, from all those places, you went to school, now you're in California. When you first got to California, what happened? What'd you do?
Well, I lived in my brother's apartment. My brother was here with his wife. They weren't married at that point. They lived in the city, San Francisco. A little one-bedroom. Actually, it was a studio. It wasn't even a one-bedroom. It was a studio. And they were visiting Massachusetts at that time. So I stayed at their place for like a week and a half or something. And used his place as a base of operations to find an apartment. And
did you have a car when you were looking for a place?
No, I haven't had a car since 2002.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So how'd you, like, get a job and an apartment and move without a car?
Well, I already had a job. I had a remote job. I was doing a textbook editing freelance. Mostly science and math and biology textbooks.
So what was it?
High school level.
So what does that do? What kind of job is that?
Well, I guess editing may not be the right word. It was, although I did do some projects where I had to create test questions
mm-hmm.
that met certain state standards. That's Inferno.
He's welcoming home the Airbnb people, and here we are. Okay, we're good now. It's good.
Okay. Just waiting for Inferno to calm down here.
Mm-hmm. Blue's probably coming out.
Yeah, so it's freelance work for a company that provided services for publishers. So a publisher comes out with a textbook. Our job was to say, okay, does this textbook meet state standards for curriculum?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's 50 states, and each textbook has to be done to each state. And so you'd go through the book and find out where certain standards were met and to what depth of knowledge. So if it was just cursory knowledge, that would be like a 1. If it was in-depth, that would be a higher point. So I did that for a while, like 7 years. So I already had a job when I came out here.
So that's cool. So you got here, you already had a steady income editing high school textbooks.
Yeah, correlating.
Correlating.
Correlating. Some test question writing, which was really cool.
That's pretty fucking awesome. How'd you get into that?
It was a little tedious eventually, but just because my buddy of mine started the company that did it.
Huh.
So I didn't have any furniture. I didn't really have anything.
What'd you leave?
I had like a computer.
What was the last? Denver or?
Where were you last? Like Massachusetts. Weymouth, Massachusetts. South Shore.
So what'd you leave in South Shore? When you left South Shore, what'd you leave there?
Like a lot of tapes. Like cassette tapes. CDs. Some of my LP albums.
Did you leave any friendships there?
I mean, I still have friends back there. Yeah. Hmm. It was a conjunction of events. And all of those. I had promised myself I'd move if certain conditions obtained, and they did.
Hmm.
So it was like my car got totaled. I got laid off after the .com bubble. And then I had a relationship, which also ended.
All at the same time?
Yeah. All within like a couple weeks or something.
Wow.
Oh, and my band broke up.
Wow.
Yeah.
What year was that?
Like 2003.
How old were you?
I guess I was 28.
Huh. Some call that your Saturn return.
No, what?
Saturn return.
What is that?
It's like a term I don't fully understand that is to describe usually human beings, men and women, Saturn's cycle of distance between the Earth and, I don't know. I don't exactly know, but what it is like that when it's about that timeline, like 28 to 31, a lot of people report shit like that happening all at the same time.
Mm.
Right at that age range.
Yeah.
And that's usually pretty life-changing. Usually yeah, it changes the direction in some ways.
It did, literally.
Yeah.
The spatial direction of where I was going.
Totally. So, like, I've reported... I have, like, definitely have that. And a lot of people I know, I guess. Yeah. So, it's interesting to notice that they're all uniquely important... and educational, and there it seemed to be like the depth at the which, you know, one thing affected another thing is like something that's nuanced seemingly forever.
Can you hear yourself through that mic?
I can. Okay, I can hear. Should we turn it up?
No, just making sure the battery was still functional.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Yeah, and also my brother was out here.
Hmm. What's his name?
I have one sibling. His name's Alfred. And
Alfred
also,
Cloutier?
Yes. And also my good friend from college was out here, too. Actually, a few people from college were out here. So it seemed like a good place to go. I was considering Maine, like the boonies of Maine.
Huh.
But I think that would have been too isolated. Just, you know, live in a house and write, essentially. But I think that would have been too isolating.
Yeah.
But it would have been a different life path thing. I could see myself thriving in that kind of environment too, but I'm glad I'm out here.
Nice.
And I had some savings because my car was totaled. I also got a severance package from being laid off. So I had all this money.
Nice.
So that was a good, that gave me a good start.
A little buffer.
Yeah.
Surfboard. That's fucking cool.
So I guess I've been out here like 10, 11 years now.
When you think about like the next 5 to 10 years, do you picture yourself still being in this area?
Yeah, next 5 years, yeah.
Yeah.
And you're a native Californian, is that right?
That's true. I was born in Redwood City.
Okay. Which is where?
That is in the mid-peninsula. It's kind of in between San Francisco and San Jose. It's kind of rated in a government test sense like the best weather and the craziest streets. Like they're all kinds of directions and lots of one ways, and it's very confusing.
Were there a lot of horses and carriages in its early years? Is that why?
Yeah. One of the studios I rented in Redwood City was built in 1912, and in the back of it there's a skinny ass roadway between buildings where the garages were. There's this courtyard and then garages. It was really beautiful, all set up for horse and carriage, like stables. So at the time I was driving a 68 supercharged Camaro to fit down the skinny, narrow way between the buildings. I had to have one tire up on the bricks on one side and diagonally drive it.
Brick cobblestone streets?
It was a concrete street that had a curb, like a sidewalk on both sides. And the only
sidewalks
way to fit,
were brick?
Yeah, sidewalks were brick. And the only way to fit would have to drive up on the brick sidewalk.
Wow. And yeah, Boston's like that. A lot of one ways, a lot of weird, curvy roads that don't seem to make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's because the horses would just go wherever and create paths. And because of those paths were eventually paved, and they were roads.
Wow.
So, yeah. But I guess California has the craziest drivers.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think, didn't they just determine that?
I'm sure.
Yeah. I always thought it was Boston or New York, but I was surprised by that. Because you think if everyone's high out here, you'd think they'd be better drivers, but...
They did do a study about being high and driving.
Yeah, it's safer, right?
Well, if
they
safer. They said if you're a new smoker, no. Like if you just started smoking and you're driving, it does not help you.
Right, especially while you're driving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but they did say is when you are a seasoned smoker and you're driving, there's like, they for sure couldn't prove that you were worse in any way.
Mm-hmm.
Because they couldn't prove that. Whether or not you're better, they didn't prove.
Right.
But they couldn't prove worse. So it's like, that's something.
It could be. Could
How
be
do you
something.
Measure that, though? Like, right. How long have you been smoking, son? What'd you have, 2 joints? Okay, you're over the limit for how young you are.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, that seems like something that couldn't be enforced, really.
No, yeah, so that's a good... Just a
so just drink. Make it legal.
Yeah, exactly.
Make it legal and you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah. There's lots of things we could make legal. Like love... You know, that'd be cool.
Yeah. Did you have a Saturn Returns moment?
There's like all kinds of
when you were 28, or
I think so. I'm
around
think,
that
like,
age,
if I could try to like distill the, I'm trying to think about what would be considered that. It's like, I don't know. I guess you could say like it started with the writing an 80-minute album. Of black metal recording it professionally, preparing a tour, getting the time off from being a flight attendant, using FMLA to go on the tour. Immediately after the tour, fly down to pick up the 60-foot yacht that I had been exploring to buy for almost a year, and finally had got the loan to come through, and finally got all the insurance to happen, and finally got a captain and fire and got it inspected, and finally...
What's FLMA, just real quick?
Family Medical Leave Act.
Ah.
Yeah. So I had a sinus infection. I still do. It's from being a flight attendant, primarily, but there's, like, snot logs in my sinuses.
Just from the air pressure changes, something?
Air pressure changes, amount of, like, different kinds of crazy germs that I encountered being on the airplane all the time with all the different people from all the different places. So it was those, but I do feel like I don't get sick very often. I do feel like I have a greater immunity overall. That like
because of all that snot that's blocking other germs from getting in or something?
I'd say yes, and that the my already experience with germs has been vast already. I got sick a bunch in the first year of being a flight attendant. Most people do.
Yeah.
Really sick, but after that, you get used to it.
So you were kind of immunized to all these...
Kind
of. All these international germs.
I do have some version of that, yeah.
Hmm.
So I don't get sick very often. It's really like once a year or less.
So your Saturn Returns moment was...
So
all this crazy...
I go on the tour. We release the album. I get back. I fly... I do a trip. I do a 3-day trip with gear for my boat trip with my flight attendant luggage. Like, I've got pots and pans and a sleeping bag and all kinds of shit. With my flight attendant gear, I'm dragging around all these cities.
Because you're planning on sleeping on the boat?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I landed, finished the trip, and then flew down to L.A. to get on the boat to discover that the captain canceled. And, I mean, we could go into a whole other story there about the whole thing about what it took to get the boat going, legally and physically. That was crazy. Yeah. Cool. So we could do a whole thing about that.
And then, save it for another topic.
Save it for another topics. Topics. Yeah. So that happens.
Topics.
And then driving the boat up, driving the boat from L.A. to Berkeley was part of my Saturn return for sure. Getting to the Berkeley Marina, how the hostel situation leading up to eventually my 5.5-year relationship ending.
Hostel as in a place to stay, or hostel as in...
The employees of the Berkeley Marina never have a sense of peace or play, or that their needs are met, or that they feel safe. They never, like, whenever you're around the Berkeley Marina, people who work there, the my experience of what they're projecting is, like, anxiety, fear, loneliness.
Like a bureaucracy of fear.
Yeah. And living there, because I had to pay them as, like, a landlord. They were my landlords.
Right. What do you think the anxiety is from? Just the scarcity of water, real estate, and the... just all
I believe that they're... experience primarily comes from the bureaucracy of Berkeley and how rationality has to go through so many fucking tubes to get back to reality in the system. It's like decades. It's crazy how much money and time they spend debating. I've been to their meetings. When I live there, they have meetings at the marina where dozens of city people come in and they all talk about all the stuff that's going on. And I went there and there were several times I had to protest for myself, like in a court-like sense, to these massive city leaders.
Just standing up for your own rights?
Standing up for what seemed like my rights. Anyway.
Is this related to noise levels?
It was. There was one of the times that this happened was Nilotep, my longtime black metal band, was recording and rehearsing full level symphonic black metal
On the boat.
On the boat, okay. That I had lived on this 60-foot yacht, and we had this extra living room where I had my drums up, and we had two full stacks and a 500-watt PA. and we put foam all around the room and did a lot of like insulating and closing, and we were really sensitive with time and stuff, and we kind of got away with it for a while, but then people complained and the complaints built up, and there's no law, there's no sound ordinance in the Berkeley Marina because people are drilling on metal with metal at 11 o'clock at night all the time because like your shit's sinking, you have to work on it, so it's like you can't really.
Do you think some of the reaction from the community was based on the type of music that was being played?
Yes, I do believe that.
Like, let's say if it was jazz or or jazz.
Jazz. Let's say it's jazz in some way.
Jazz would be fine. You think they would be fine with that?
They'd probably be fine with it. But because we were doing 500 beats per minute, blast beats, and screaming with tremolo, it was like
And metal's not a quiet. We were enterprise, is it? No.
But I have some really cool recordings from the boat. It sounded pretty crazy. But, so that happened. So there, my experience of that was like that they were, it was a very fear-based oppression hierarchy. So we had a really hard time trying to express our needs. Like, we have this need. We're paying for this space. We're paying a very large amount of money to rent this spot in the marina. We are upstanding citizens with our payments. We totally have
How much was rent?
It varied depending on which dock we were at because there's different, like, it was, that's how much bureaucracy works. It changed depending on where I was in the room.
Right.
It was different. So this one was better than that one. And
what was, like, the average price?
Like, it was between $800 and $1,100 most of the time just to have the boat parked there.
And was there rent control? Anything like that?
There probably was rent control, but like if we'd have to move at some point, it was like $850 at this one thing, but because this person hates us so much, we were forced to move to this other spot in the marina. And then that one's $1,100 because it's closer to this and has the blah, 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 and it's a newer dock from the blah, blah, blah.
Wow. You'd think there'd be enough room with all this water, right?
You'd think. I could have really imagined a way to operate the marina with empathy and imagination. You could really easily picture that.
Yeah. I think empathy and imagination could probably solve a lot of problems.
Yeah.
When applied to any problem, usually some kind of good change comes out of it.
Yeah, that's like an interesting tool to consider, like for problem solving. How do we apply empathy and imagination?
I think one demands the other too, you know. In order to find new ways to be empathetic towards something,
you have to imagine.
You have to try out different forms. And I think imagination kind of entails requires empathy too. Although I'm not sure how. I don't have a prepared statement on that. So Saturn Returns is like a bunch of things falling apart at the same around the same time.
There's like a group of tremendous challenge all at this really close together. And people report directional life change stuff, relationships, home, you know, friends.
So what happened to the boat eventually? How long did you have the boat?
I had the boat for 3.5 years.
3.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
A floating house.
Yeah. It was there in landlubber term. Three bedrooms, two bathrooms, two living rooms, a kitchen, a bar, a laundry room, an engine room, and it was four decks.
Did you have a 10 forward? Like a...
The lounge.
I guess it would be two forward, or what, deck two forward compartment. That's what 10 forward is, right?
What do you mean, like where the people hang out after work to have a drink?
Yeah,
that would be the bar.
Okay, was that in the front?
It was actually at the third level. It was right behind the main captain area. So right behind the main captain area, the captain could turn around and be the bartender. That's like what this is the same space.
As long as he doesn't get the two confused.
It was, you could be in, like, Captain Bartender is totally possible, because you could pour a drink and there could be, you could be going a direction.
Hmm.
It came with autopilot, but I never got it to work. I really wanted it to, but I never actually
got it. Seems like a dicey thing.
Yeah.
On a boat.
It was old school.
I mean, cruise control.
This boat
was
from 1969. It was mahogany.
Huh.
It was wooden. It looked like a James Bond yacht. It was cool. We practiced metal. We painted it black. We had dog on it. Raised my puppy dog on it. Had a lot of cool parties. Did a lot of social activism.
What was the name?
Met
of
a
the
lot
boat?
Of people.
What was the name?
Naglfar.
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 That was the name of the boat.
Yeah, Naglfar. Norse mythology is Loki's ship.
That's right.
It's made of human bones and/or fingernails.
Right, Loki
sails into port, signifying Ragnarok, the end of the world.
Loki's a slippery one, isn't he?
Isn't he? Cool ship though.
He was the nemesis of Thor, right? Was that
the
true?
Brother.
Brother.
And kind of nemesis, right. Too.
Was it Freya?
What's that?
Isn't Freya one of the Norse
I'm not mythology? That familiar with Norse mythology. I know some stuff.
Yeah. I think I'm out of my element here.
Yeah. What was that?
So Naglfar.
Naglfar, the boat.
A black 60-foot yacht.
Mm-hmm. 1969, mahogany.
Hmm.
It leaked crazily, like rain. When it rained, it would leak. And unfortunately, the most common place that the droplets would go would be on your pillow. That was like, you'd be sleeping, and you'd be, doot, and you're like, fuck. And that was every time it rained, except for when it didn't rain too hard, sometimes. Sometimes if it didn't rain too hard, you could, it would never actually get to your head.
So there's water coming in.
There's water
from
coming
below in. And from above.
Yeah.
When it rains.
Yeah. Fresh water eats away at the wood. Salt water preserves it.
Right. Was the hull rebuilt?
The hull was rebuilt before we motored it up from LA.
Oh.
Twin screw Detroit 8V71 2-stroke diesels. Totally awesome engines. They were, it's cool, they're 2-stroke V8s. The pistons are fucking huge.
Yeah.
And they're so simple. The maintenance is like, change the oil. That's basically it.
They're just
and
work,
they'll go
workhorses.
300,000 miles and have a million pounds of torque. Not really a million, but like, they kick butt. And I, too, it's cool because they're independent. I could drive it like a tank. Like, one forward, one aft, and it would spin.
That's cool.
So that was cool. Scared the shit out of the captain when I went on the test drive to buy it. I went to do that in the ocean, the open ocean, and there's big waves and shit. He looked at me like, his eyes got huge, and I was like, it's okay, dude.
Yeah, you had experience.
Oh, yeah. I've been on boats my whole life.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming onto the land for this podcast.
You're very welcome.
Yeah.
Yeah, my dad, we always had boats when I was growing up. Him and my mother's father built boats together. I built a wooden boat with my grandpa, which we then used in the bay to paddle around.
Motor boats?
Paddle boat, motor boat, both.
Like sailboats?
There was one sailboat, but all the rest were power boats.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, the last biggest one when my dad, the last one he owned before he passed, was this 28-foot cabin cruiser thing. It was like, had a bed in the front and bathroom and a kitchen and water and, you know, it could sleep like six and he would take that out on the Delta and go in lakes and stuff and you could ski behind it and barbecue on it. It was pretty cool. But it was old. It wasn't like new. Like you'd be like, whoa, this is so shiny. It's not like, no, like when you touch the paint, it comes off on you.
Huh.
And a lot of sharp edges.
So you had experience with boats. Mm-hmm. You wanted a boat. Why did you want a boat?
Well, you know, it's like I'd gone through all these. I've moved a lot. I think I've lived 20 places. I think I've had 20 addresses personally.
Hmm.
And I had, like, the last place before I lived was in San Jose. Right before that, I was living in the Santa Cruz Mountains at Butano, at the top of this mountain in this weird castle garage apartment. I was living in San Jose after that, and from there, I was like, why the fuck? I just had the idea. One day, I was on the Amtrak, actually. I was going by the retired fleet you can see out there on your way out to Sacramento. Mm-hmm. If you ride Amtrak, you see the moth. What do they call that? The mothballs or something?
The mothballed fleet?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I look at those ships. I'm, like, thinking about empathy and imagination and the zeitgeist movement and a resource-based economy. And I'm like, I could fucking build a resource-based economy on one of those boats.
Yeah.
I was like, a retired naval ship has the capacity to really be really well organized scientifically to meet needs of people if they were being measured and accounted for and tested to see if it was actually happening and then reclosing the loop in the scientific method sense.
Right.
And can we meet the needs of our people using the scientific method or other methods? And let's go for it.
Yeah.
And, but you can't really get those boats. They're not like, you can't go get a loan and then they'll go, sure, you can have a retired
and then get a ship. Battleship or something.
I don't think you can do that.
Or frigate.
So I looked online for what else I could get. And I was like, okay, a fucking sustainable resource-based yacht community. Fuck yeah. How do I do that? And I was like, what could I get a loan for? And I was like, probably like 50,000 bucks because I was a flight attendant and they were like some, probably. I was like, I could probably do that.
Mm-hmm.
It had some car loans for like $8,000 or something. I was like, maybe that would work. And a lot of boat experience, which I could legally list, you know, it finally happened.
Cool. Did you have roommates?
I did. I lived with the person I had lived with for many years beforehand, Evan Jenks. We lived on the boat. He did, like, the moving of my stuff from the home in San Jose. He, like, packed up my items into a truck, drove them to Berkeley Marina, helped tie the boat up, and then we unloaded everyone's stuff into the boat. He lived with me there the whole time, and other people came and went.
Hmm. Would you say that the experiment was a success?
You know, there was a long time directly after and during the experience that I felt it was a mistake. There was like about 2/3 of the way through living on the boat, I was really regretting owning it because of what ended up sucking out of what I wasn't really able to give and how I would try to knot myself to give more than I could even when I was totally at a zero.
Because of all the maintenance and all the bureaucracy.
Maintenance, bureaucracy, friendship, relationship, partner, roommate, who does the fucking dishes, where's the boat sinking? Like, it was so crazy to be the only leader.
Mm-hmm.
Where my friends were depending on me to make this boat work, which is insane.
Yeah.
I could have a whole episode on poop. On how I had to fight poop on that boat. Yeah. Some other time.
Shit war.
The shit war.
Yeah.
I won.
Bring that in as a topics.
Yeah. So it was super intense and I regretted it for a long time. But like as of late, I more am able to recognize that the lessons learned about that. About like leadership. And what that means. And holding space and being able to grow. And it was just like, looking back now, it's more of still like a really hot topic. It's still like, singes. Mm. But I'm able to more see the real benefit. Because I really held it as a regret.
For a while. You seem to speak fondly of it when you reminisce about the boat.
Yeah.
Even though they're usually stories of agony, pain, and you know, trials. You had an experiment, and you performed the experiment.
Yeah, end we had a garden on the roof. We at one point did have we had 4 people. We had a washer and dryer. We had 50-amp power. We did have homebrew on tap at the bar. With washer and dryer inside with soap that we made.
So it was pretty self-sufficient, except for all the, like, infrastructure and stuff that comes from outside.
Right.
Like, power.
So we got it going pretty cool, and more cool things are on the way. But it did, in the end, sink.
Yeah. Was there a straw that broke the hull, so to speak?
You know, it's...
Or was it just leaky? Yeah.
It's still
a mystery.
That's a mystery. That's okay. A fun story too. Why the boat sank. How the boat sank. It's totally a story.
Why it sank.
Why it sank.
Huh.
You know, because there's this how. and there's the why, and there's the when, and the where.
How is pretty much water filled it up.
How is water filled it up?
So it was no longer buoyant.
How the water filled it up is a mystery still. So it's true that the water was in there, and then it was too heavy, and then it was falling over.
Sabotage ever cross your mind?
Like,
people have argued
because I was so trying to get rid of it at the time. It was for sale online. I had shown it to 3 people. I was getting some interest. I was really, really, really trying to get rid of it because I was over it emotionally, financially, physically, psychologically. I was trying to sell it, and I thought I was getting closer to selling it, and we're getting kicked out of the Berkeley Arena, and so we had to move to Emeryville, where I heard there was more burners, and I was like, okay, cool. We started to go. I had everyone on board because everyone was in town for Thanksgiving.
Mm.
And my snake, a dog, a cat, and 9 people, I think, were on board when the boat got about a third underwater, and the engines were submerged, full of water.
Mm-hmm.
And it was starting to get about knee height in the bedroom levels. Like, if you were standing in my bedroom, it would be about getting to your knees.
And then you just evacuated all your stuff?
No, we evacuated people and pets. I put my snake around my neck.
What about all your shit?
I mean, some of my shit got totally destroyed, like mostly paperwork stuff.
Mm.
Boots. Just like, yeah, some stuff like import, like boots I was going to wear at Burning Man got totally like,
yeah.
Nah. But like my drums stayed above the waterline. My bike stayed above the waterline. Okay.
All the technology stuff.
My computer stayed and phone all above the waterline. So like it basically totaled the boat, which I paid. It was $40,000
to
when I bought it. I bought it for $40,000. Right. I had been paying payments on it. So insurance eventually had to pay up.
How much had you paid off? How much was left to pay on it?
I think something like $29,000 was left to pay.
Wow.
$28,000, something like that.
Hmm.
I think I got like, I don't know, but it was an interesting event. And then I got to here, where this is the first place I lived since that happened. I actually had to live on my boat for about a month after it had sank and the pumps pumped out the water. And they towed it to Emeryville. And I lived on it there for about a month because there's nowhere else I could live.
It was just dry and dry dock?
It was, no. What happened was they pumped the water out in the bay, and they towed me in and tied me up. And when I plugged in my 110 backup pump system, it kept pumping and it was fine.
Do you think you'd get another boat?
Only under certain conditions, but I would consider it, yeah.
So you've thought about it.
It's come up. It's interesting. My partner, she said she'd live with me on the boat. You know, it's a cool way to live.
Well, we got like an hour and 15 minutes worth of material here.
Yeah. Should we like do like think of, you want to try like a wrap-up activity or another song or something?
We could always interject a song somewhere. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what did we talk about? We talked about Saturn Returns. We talked about the boat.
Yeah.
Talked about where I've lived.
Mm-hmm.
Why I came out here.
Mm-hmm.
Talked a little bit about empathy and imagination. Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah, cool.
Pretty fun first episode.
Thanks for listening.
See you next time.